Airline Pilot Guy, episode number 38. Hello, you're listening to the Airline Pilot Guy Show, the view from my side of the cockpit door. I'm Captain Jeff, your host, broadcasting live from Studio 715 at the Holiday Inn in Portland, Maine. On today's show, a loss of separation between three jets in Washington, D.C., the near miss of a American Airlines 777 and a Air Force C-17, a United 737 bird strike, bees on a plane, and much more. So, get all settled in, sit back, and relax. Flight 38 is ready for pushback. Hello, hello. Sorry I didn't get a podcast out last week. I had intended to, but I'll tell you what, you know, if you know and have listened to the these shows. If you know me and have listened to my previous episodes, you know that I like flying these trips that are early in the day. Now, the good thing is I get to where I'm going to early and hopefully avoid some of the more severe, nasty weather and associated delays and such as the day goes on. You know, kind of feel like you have a real layover. You can get in, maybe go for a walk or, you know, get a nice meal, get some exercise in, whatever. And get a relatively decent night's sleep. Of course, the downside is that you have to get up really early. And so I flew a four-day trip a couple of weeks ago, and it was one of those type of trips. Then I had 2 days off, then back out for a two-day and then a three-day. And after a while, these 3:15, 3:20 a.m. Report or not, or get-ups start getting to you. And I was just getting really, really run down. So the plan was on Wednesday of last week, I left for a three-day trip. And the cool thing about that trip is that day two, I was to arrive in Pensacola about, before 9 o'clock Central Daylight Time. So I had a very long layover there, and I had major plans to record episode number 38 at that time. Well, problem is that when we left Tallahassee, Florida at 5:45 in the morning, so do the math, had to get up really early for that one. We were taxiing out or applying the power for taxiing out for takeoff. I mean, it was so early that the tower wasn't even open. We were going to have to pick up our flight plan from Jacksonville Center and, you know, take off the old-fashioned way without ground control or tower controllers giving us any help or clearances at the airport. But anyway, that's not why I'm telling you the story. We had a little issue with the right generator of this MD-90, and it kept falling offline, and we tried to reset it, and it didn't work. So finally, we determined that we had to return to the gate, and then we had to wait for contract maintenance. You know, it used to be a long time ago in the good old days. Just about every place that Acme flew, we had mechanics on staff. And in fact, it was one of the things that we'd do as we'd approach the gate. The mechanic would be standing there waiting for you to arrive at your gate, and you'd basically give him a thumbs up, or him or her, a thumbs up or a thumbs down to let them know whether or not they need to come up right away to talk to us to see what the write-ups may be, what the problem might be. But I don't know how long ago it was, probably at least 15 years ago, maybe even 20 years ago. Acme decided that they were spending a lot of money, you know, in staffing all of these locations with mechanics. So they decided in a money-saving move to only have mechanics staffed at our major airports, especially our hubs and then some of the bigger airports like Washington, D.C. and others like that. So, when you have a maintenance issue at an airport that doesn't have an Acme mechanic staffed, you have to call contract maintenance. Well, Acme in Atlanta does. And so these are people usually working for other airlines, perhaps retired mechanics. Excuse me, retired mechanics that are on call to work on airplanes and such. And you know, depending on where you are and how far the mechanic lives from the airport, you might have to wait a while. Well, we waited. Actually, the contract mechanic arrived pretty quickly after Acme in Atlanta called up, and got out there and determined to, or he determined, or Atlanta did, determined to, or decided to defer the engine generator, and we can operate legally like that. We have something that's cleared with the FAA that kind of tells what is the minimum required equipment to operate the flight, and so all of those things were satisfied. We had to run our auxiliary power unit for the full flight so that we'd have a backup source of electricity, a backup generator, and that was sharing the electrical load. So we got all that stuff taken care of. He had to go check the oil level and the APU to make sure that it was going to run the entire flight, which is a very short flight from Tallahassee to Atlanta. And then the paperwork, that's what really takes the longest. So finally, we got out of there a couple hours after our, well, not quite a couple hours after our scheduled departure time, but we were late. And because of our late arrival into Atlanta, well, guess what? Our nice short Atlanta to Pensacola flight departed on time with a different crew. And that meant that my first officer and I had to do something different. And in this case, it was to go from a nice, easy two-leg day. It turned into a four-leg day. So we had, once we got to Atlanta, we had to quickly go over to another gate, fly from Atlanta to Jacksonville, Florida, then back to Atlanta. And then once we were back there, had to wait a little while, and then deadhead on a DC-9 to Pensacola. So we didn't get in until, 4 o'clock, 4:30, 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And there went my day for recording this podcast. And so I thought, well, no problem. I'll get in and you know, push the record button and get this thing out of the way. I was beat when we got back to the room. I just couldn't do it. And so I thought, no problem. I'll just do it when I'm at home this weekend. Well, as many of you know, there are a lot of things going on in my house and with my family and other things unrelated to the airline pilot guy. And so those took precedence, and wasn't able to record the show. So here I am now. It's a Wednesday, and I'm in beautiful Portland, Maine. Beautiful day here. Last time I was here, it was a little stormy, but today is really nice, and I can't wait to get out there and walk around the city and grab a bite to eat, hopefully some good seafood and some good local beer, perhaps. Anyway, let's get on with this show. Now, you may have heard about this story. This was last week. I believe it was on Tuesday at DCA, Washington National Airport. Apparently, the airplane or airport was operating to the south. And so they were, they were operating to the north. And so they were taking off to the north, and you know the whole story there. You take off and then immediately make a left turn to fly up the Potomac River, avoiding the P-56 restricted area, you know, containing the White House and the Capitol and Washington Monument and the whole thing. And when you're coming in for landing, you're coming in from the south along the Potomac River past Mount Vernon, and we call that the Mount Vernon visual when the weather is good enough to operate on a visual approach basis. And so that's what the airport was doing. That was the operation. However, some weather started building south of the airport, and it was decided that the airport get changed, the configuration changed from a north flow to a south flow. And now you might wonder why that is. Well, you know, changing what we call it, turning the airport around, and that happens quite often in a lot of the airports that we fly in. If a weather system comes through and the winds shift around, then of course we want to be taking off and landing into the wind as much as possible. In this case, that could have been the situation where the wind was starting to shift, or it could be that this big thunderstorm complex is kind of becoming an obstacle for traffic approaching from the south, and so it's a better way to get airplanes in and out of DCA by using the runway in a southerly configuration. So, in any case, the decision was made by the FAA to turn the airport around or go from a south to a north operation. So, I hope I didn't get all those directions confused there, but you understand what I'm talking about here. So, what happens during this time is that approach control starts setting things up, queuing airplanes, usually involving holding patterns to delay everybody coming in while the tower facility at the airport gets things cleared up on the ground. And what that means is there are already airplanes that have been taxied to the current runway in use, in this case, runway 19, heading to the south. I'm sorry, I keep mixing that up. I'm terribly sorry. I must still be tired. In this case, runway 1 was still in use, operating to the north. And they probably had a group of airplanes down there already. And so the ones that were calling for taxi at that point were given instructions to taxi for runway 19. And so you have a lot of commotion on the ground, getting things sorted out. In the meantime, as I mentioned, approach control is kind of changing the flow of everything and delaying flights in the air in holding patterns and that kind of thing, vectoring. And then the switch is flipped, and now magically everything is operating the other direction. Well, the problem is that there was a miscommunication apparently between the terminal radar approach control facility, Potomac Approach, and the DCA tower crew. And the TRACON, the Potomac Approach Control, had already cleared a flight to start flying the river visual approach. So this airplane is coming in from the northwest and along the river, and they're going to make that quick little turn at the very end and land to the south on runway 19 at DCA. The only problem is the folks in the tower cab at DCA aren't quite ready for this yet. They're still trying to sort out everything on the ground. They're still clearing people for takeoff, flights for takeoff on runway 1. And so let's listen to a little bit of the tape, and you can hear a little bit of the confusion in the tower cab.
Chautauqua 3071, wind calm. Runway 1 cleared for takeoff.
Runway 1 clear to go, Chautauqua 3071.
Brickyard 3467, runway 1 line up and wait.
Runway 1 line up and wait, Brickyard 3467.
Okay, again, she is clearing out all that traffic that's waiting for takeoff on runway 1. They're taking off to the north. She's just cleared one for takeoff, and now she's put another one into position.
Brickyard 3443, just hold right there. I'm going to pass you up one time due to spacing over Montebello.
Okay.
Chautauqua 3071, contact Potomac Departure, and y'all have a good day.
Departure, Chautauqua 3071, see you later.
Brickyard 3467, wind calm, runway 1, cleared for takeoff.
Runway 1, cleared to go, Brickyard 3467.
Brickyard 3395, runway 1, line up and wait.
1, line up and wait, Brickyard 3395. Brickyard 3329 is on the river.
Brickyard.
Okay, right there, you notice there's a little hesitation. Like, who? Brickyard 3329, what? Where are you?
Come on, Angela.
Obviously, one of the pilots on one of the flights on the frequency knows this tower controller, and her name apparently is Angela.
Austin Tower, 2-1, Felicity, Burke Lake, northbound Fairfax Hospital.
And Brickyard 3329, are you with me?
Yeah, I'm with you on the river.
All right, Brickyard 3329, turn south heading 180.
All right, 180-3329.
Okay, so she realizes that, oh, I just cleared a couple flights for takeoff on runway 1, heading immediately to the northwest, and now Brickyard 3329 has just come on frequency And he is on the river visual coming in the opposite direction, coming in from the northwest. And so immediately she makes the appropriate command, or gives the appropriate instructions, and tells him to turn right heading 180 to kind of, you know, called off the approach there, basically, and so that he doesn't continue flying down the river and into the path of these airplanes taking off.
And Breakout 3329, traffic just heading to your left is the CRJ departing out of 2200.
Yeah, we're working on him, 3329.
Okay, you know, he's got a good sense of humor. At first, when he was given the instruction to turn right heading 180, you can kind of tell a little bit of annoyance in his voice that he's gotten called off the approach. And again, I don't know all the details. I don't know if that flight had been out there holding while they were doing the runway changes at DCA. So he is already probably thinking about the fact that, okay, the flight is already late now because of the runway change, and I burned through a lot of fuel, so I don't have a lot of extra fuel to be fooling around here. And so that that might be the reason for the frustration, negative sound in his voice. And then, of course, a little bit of a chuckle there when she calls out the traffic to him. He says, yeah, I see him there. Like, what's going on here?
You have an altitude for us?
Brickyard 3467, traffic at your 11 o'clock and 2 miles is the 170 at 1800 southbound.
Brickyard 3467, we're looking.
Okay, you might have heard a little bit of that commotion in the background when she's keying her microphone button. Her microphone's picking up not only her voice, but I hear some voices in the background. It sounds like there is quite a bit of commotion in the background in that tower cab, trying to figure out what is happening there. Again, you know, it sounds like the Potomac approach, the terminal radar approach control facility, basically opened up the stream of traffic coming in from the northwest a little bit earlier than DCA had anticipated.
Breakout 3329, turn right, heading 020.
That's 020, 3329.
And breakout 3329, turn right, heading 090.
90 heading, and there's a
2000. Yeah, some more communication that we would not hear on the frequency. That's some of the back channels that the tower cab and the approach control used to communicate.
Brickyard 3467, contact the Potomac departure.
Over to departure, Brickyard 3467. We'll see you.
Brickyard 3395, continue holding on the runway.
3395.
And Brickyard 3329, you can contact standby. And Brickyard 3329, turn right, heading 180.
180, and we were clear at the river back there. What happened?
Good question.
Admiral Tower 411 is zone 3 to zone 1, landing mid, sir.
And Breakout 3395, taxi down the runway to runway 22 and turn left on runway 22.
Taxi down the runway to 22, left on 22, Breakout 3395.
Breakout.
Okay.
Yeah, what's your plans for us at 3329?
Breakout 3329, stand by. We're trying to figure this out, too. Stand by.
Okay. Well, as you can hear, a lot of confusion there. Now, you know, the controllers did the right thing when they to resolve the situation anyway. They're still investigating how the whole thing happened to begin with. And just a few days ago, the FAA has stated that they're going to start formalizing procedures for turning the airport around at all facilities in the United States. And so perhaps this was something good is going to come from this, that there is going to be a little bit more attention paid to procedures when they switch the flow of traffic in and out of big airports. So. Now, of course, the media, that's another story. They took this story and made it sound like, you know, it was a terrible tragedy averted. Hundreds of lives could have been lost. just seconds from impact and all that kind of stuff. Well, no, it was, if you're running with visual approaches, the weather is good. You can see miles, especially if you're flying the river visual approach. Usually you can see quite a ways. The airplanes never got closer than about, well, it was less than 2 miles. I think the standard separation is 1,000 feet vertically and 3 miles horizontally. So they kind of breached that 3 mile radius barrier of separation. But it wasn't like, you know, the people were looking out their window and saw the color of the eyes of the people in the other airplane. It wasn't anything close like that. But it was significant. Every time you operate into DCA or any big airport, but especially DCA, because there's not a lot of real estate there at that airport, and there's a lot of traffic flying in and out of there. Just about every time I fly into DCA, we're getting very close to other airplanes as we're on final. On short final, sometimes the airplane is already on the runway and is being cleared for takeoff, and you're hoping that that airplane is going to be airborne by the time you touch down, because if not, you know, as you know from listening to the show, we can't have two airplanes using the same runway at the same time, even if they're at the opposite ends of the runway. Then you have to do a go-around procedure, and then, you know, that has a bunch of risks involved as well, so, or potential risks. So every time we go into DCA, we're getting close to airplanes, so that's not unusual or not uncommon. But in this case, it was a little bit different because there was an airplane coming in basically on the same path that the folks that were leaving were taking, the opposite direction. So again, it wasn't as close as the media made it sound. At all times, safety was not breached, but it did kind of bring to light some potential flaws in the system that they're using for turning the airport around. So enough of that. Now, speaking of near misses, this one actually occurred, I believe, in January of 2011, so about a year and a half ago, and the NTSB has been investigating it, and I think they just recently filed or released their final report about this. And so let me read you a little bit of this story. Federal investigators released alarming details about controller errors that nearly caused a mid-air collision last year between a heavily loaded American Airlines jet and a military cargo plane off the East Coast, highlighting problems at New York's premier traffic control facility. A report by the NTSB disclosed mistakes and miscommunications. There is that word again, miscommunication. By air traffic controllers, ending with the two big planes speeding on converging courses in the dark off the coast of New York. The jets, both at 22,000 feet, barreled directly toward each other for at least 1 minute without pilots seeing the other aircraft or realizing the extent of the danger. At one point, controllers watched helplessly as alarms sounded. It says in the cockpit of the Boeing 777. I think the alarms that they're talking about here, probably there were alarms in the control facility that kind of watch traffic, and when they get kind of close or it looks like they're going to have a loss of separation, there are some alarms that go off. And I think that I have at least two professional air traffic controllers listening to the show, so they can tell me whether or not I'm right or wrong about that. Apparently also the traffic collision avoidance system, the TCAS system on the 777 was also issuing RAs, which is resolution advisories, to monitor vertical speed or decline or descend or whatever the case in this particular situation was. And looks like the C-17's wingtip passed about 2,000 feet horizontally to the left of the passenger jet, a distance of just 10 times the width of the 777. The planes normally should have been spaced at least 1,000 feet apart vertically and several miles laterally. So the catastrophe was averted. Apparently what happened is that some people noticed that they were on converging courses, and the altitude that the 777 was cleared to was going to be a a conflict with this C-17. There were two C-17s out there. The C-17s are cargo, U.S. Air Force cargo jets. They had just finished a refueling exercise, and they were out there in the same airspace out over the Atlantic. And one of the controllers was supposed to stop the American 777's climb at 20,000 feet and then 21,000 feet. I guess he was told by another controller that he needed to do that. But the controller that was actually controlling the 777 was involved and distracted by giving some clearances to other airplanes. And he never did stop or limit the climb of the 777. And so the air traffic controllers in the facility just kind of looked helplessly at the radar screen as the two targets came together on the screen, and apparently it was a pretty close call. So in this case, it was a miss, and it was a near miss or a near hit, whichever. You know, I always thought that was kind of an oxymoron term. But so again, we're looking at, or the FAA is looking at, the procedures for controlling airplanes. And I think another factor here was that the C-17s were on a different frequency. They'd already been handed off to a different sector of air traffic control. So the 777 crew had no idea that the C-17 was out there. And at the same time, the C-17 had no idea that the American Airlines 777 was there. So again, could have been a big disaster. Lots of people on the 777 heading down to, I think, Brazil. Okay, so let's see. Take a look at this next incident that happened relatively recently. I believe last week, July 31st, actually. So, yeah, last week.
When 1475 is approaching, you're landing in Denver.
Okay, we have a, we got a problem up here. We got a bird strike. I got a very loud noise coming from the forward part of the fuselage, and the captain has launched his airspeed indicator.
United 1475, Roger, altimeter 3016, verify you have Bravo.
I'm sorry, I got to pause this right here. Now, the approach controller just got this emergency call. Well, I don't know if he's declared an emergency or not yet, but he has just received this call from a United 737 that had a bird strike. The captain has lost his airspeed indications, and this guy says, you know, do you have information Bravo? Okay, the information Bravo is the automatic terminal information service, the ATIS system that gives us information about the airport operation. I would, you know, think that that's not a major concern at this point. If there's some important information that you need to give to this crew right now, it's not to have them on their own figure out what ATIS identifier is in use at. But maybe it's just a natural thing. That's just kind of part of the thing that you say to people when they check in on your frequency. I don't know. So maybe I should cut them some slack.
United 1475, heading 350, vectors to runway 26.
All right, 350, vectors 26, 1475. I'll tell you what, let's have the truck. I'm not sure what's happening in the front of the fuselage. Just have the truck wait for us here.
United 1475, Roger, and maintain.
Okay, when he's saying, let's have the trucks, he's basically saying, look, this is an emergency situation. Have the fire crash rescue folks in position at the airport near the runway, because I'm not sure how this is going to end. You can hear also in the background the transmission from the United 737-900 that it's quite noisy in that cockpit right now, because the bird that they hit was a very large bird, and probably a goose, and has left a quite large hole in the radome on the airplane. So it was a major strike. So the thing of most concern at this point is the fact that the captain doesn't have any airspeed indications at all. And I believe that we'll listen to some more of this here, but I believe the first officer's airspeed indication was unreliable as well.
10 knots or greater, we'll get him out there.
219-210, engine 1475. 10,000. Right now, it looks like we have no airspeed indicators at all.
No airspeed indicator.
United 1475, Roger. No airspeed speed indicator.
Okay, the captain's got no airspeed at all, and the first officer is, looks like it's inaccurate here.
Windshield side. You we'll plan for vectors to the ILS for runway 26.
All right, you know what? We're not going to be able to do that, looks like. You know what, sir? Standby.
King Air 76 Kilo Pacific Solar.
Got a lot of confusion going on in that cockpit right now, trying to ascertain what's
Roger, can you see
what's working and what's not working.
11 o'clock, 20 miles.
Yeah, I got it.
United 1475, Roger. Just playing the visual then. Descend to maintain 9,000. The Saratoga traffic, no factor.
All right, 9,000. Yeah, 1475.
United 1475, contact approach 133.62.
1475.
Okay, they're switching over. Hello.
United 1475, Denver Tower, wind 220 at 20, runway 26, clear to land.
Hello, 2-6-3-9-1475.
United 1475, I can give you a radar indicated ground speed if you need that. At 1475, Roger, speed indicates 180 knots.
Roger.
I'll give you another check on about a 2 mile final.
Almost sounds like they're on the mask, oxygen mask.
I need a speed check, 1475.
Speed indicates 150 knots.
Okay, let's talk about this a little bit. Obviously, not a good thing. They hit a large bird, put a big hole in the radome. Took out some of the pitot tubes, apparently, which is required for airspeed indications. Now, he said, I'll give you some ground-based radar, ground speed readouts. That is the speed at which you're tracking over the ground. Now, let's talk a little bit about different types of speeds that we use in flying. Well, airspeed is the number one thing that we use. That's the actual speed at which the airplane thinks it's flying through the air, okay, or is flying through the air. So that's the indicated airspeed, the airspeed that's indicated on your little airspeed indicator that's right in front of you. There's also something called true airspeed, which is basically indicated airspeed adjusted for the compressibility of air, temperature, other factors. And the higher you get, your indicated airspeed may be, let's say, 220 knots. Your true airspeed might be as high as 400-something knots. And the other speed is ground speed, the speed at which you're actually flying over the ground. And that's going to determine, you know, how long the flight is going to take, et cetera, because, you know, you're traveling. You might want to think about this, again, the old comparison to a boat in a river, and you have current. And, of course, airplanes are flying through the air with the currents of air. If you're flying or you're in a boat and the river has a current of, let's say, 10 knots, and your boat is traveling at 12, well, the and you're flowing upstream, your net speed is 2 knots. Same thing with flying in the air. You have wind that may be at your tail, or wind that you're flying into. And so your ground speed is going to be your true airspeed adjusted for the wind or the current of air that you're flying through. So as you get closer to the ground, usually wind speeds start dropping off. So your true airspeed and your ground speed are getting close to the same value. Same thing with your indicated airspeed. As you get closer to the ground and closer to landing, your indicated airspeed, your true airspeed, your ground speeds are all going to be getting closer and closer together. Okay. Except, let's throw in a little bit of a factor here, because Denver, obviously, the mile-high city, is 5,000 some odd feet above sea level. So the higher you get above sea level, the difference between your true airspeed and your indicated airspeed is higher. So I've been, since I've heard about this particular incident, I've been kind of paying attention, looking at my area navigation system, the FMS, the system that we have that determines what our internal ground speed is, the speed at which the computer thinks our airplane is traveling over the ground. And then I've been kind of noting what my indicated airspeed is and true airspeed is. And at normal altitudes, anywhere from sea level to 1,000 feet above the ground, which is Atlanta, or 1,000 feet above mean sea level, I should say, the difference is maybe getting close to touchdown, maybe 10 knots. You go up a couple thousand feet, maybe about 20 knots. So up here in Denver, the true airspeed and the indicated airspeed, the difference is going to be maybe 20 to 30 knots. So this is something you have to think about as a pilot as you're coming in and somebody is giving you a ground speed of 150. You have to, you know, kind of mentally subtract your wind speeds, and you have to kind of make the adjustment in your head for the difference between indicated airspeed and true airspeed. So basically, it gives you an idea of how fast the airplane is flying through the airstream, and that's the most important thing to us, because that's the speed at which the wing thinks that the wind is flowing over it, and of course that's what causes lift, the wind flowing over your wing. So you don't want to get too slow. Now, you don't want to carry too much speed either, because the more speed you carry, the more momentum you have, and the more energy you have to dissipate when you land. So you have to weigh all these things, but it helps. It's better than not having any indication at all of what your speed is. And again, let's go back to what I preach all the time. Pilots out there, you got to know, you know, your pitch attitudes, power settings for various configurations. If you're in the landing configuration, you know, and level, like 0 degrees pitch or 1 degree or 2 degrees pitch, and this power setting, either EPER setting or fuel flow setting, is going to give me this performance at this weight. And then you make little adjustments for the weight of the airplane. And we have to know that, because guess what? Things aren't always going to be working. And this is an example of a situation where they've lost their airspeed, and they have to know approximately what kind of pitch attitude, what kind of power setting is going to give you whatever airspeed you should have to continue to fly based on the weight. So that was cool. The controller giving the United flight the ground speed readings for cross-checking their airspeed, etc. Probably a lot more about indicated true airspeed and ground speed than you wanted to know, and there's probably a lot more that I could say about it. But just thought I'd throw that out there. And, if you're wondering, everything had a happy ending in this case. The airplane landed safely, and there are some pictures that I'll include, hopefully, if I remember, in the show notes of the radome and the big hole that was put there by the by hitting the goose or whatever kind of bird it was. And so anyway, happy ending. Great job for those pilots on the United flight 1475, Denver, Colorado. All right, let's see. We're at 38 minutes already. I can't believe I just yap too much, don't I? I need to talk faster, I guess. May have heard about this. I think a few of you sent me links to this story. The Boeing 787 Dreamliner is being built not only up in Washington State by Boeing, but also at their new facility in Charleston, South Carolina. And federal officials are trying to determine why debris fell from one of the engines of a new Dreamliner at the Charleston International Airport. Debris flew from the engine, which was a Rolls-Royce engine, starting a fire, a grass fire at the airport, and they had to shut down the airport for about an hour. And so they're looking into what happened there. Yeah, not good when your engine starts falling apart and lighting things on fire, eh? Perhaps a little bit more amusing and interesting, this story at Pittsburgh last week. let's see. It sounds like bees swarming. You like that? Yeah, I had to find a little sound clip of bees. At Pittsburgh International Airport, the buzz is all about the bees on a plane. Boy, these reporters love to get kind of funny. Let's see. Wednesday night, I think this was last week, a Delta commuter flight loaded with passengers are about to take off for New York. Well, not really. They were, I'm not even sure if they had boarded the airplane yet. It was a regional jet sitting on the ramp, and they may have been in the boarding process. They had not moved away from the gate yet. The reason why I know that is because, well, the delay is due to the fact that the fueler who came out to the airplane to put fuel on the jet for the flight noticed something kind of odd about the wing, the backside of the wing. A big, huge swarm of, I don't know, thousands, tens of thousands of honeybees were attached to the trailing edge of the right wing, I believe. And that fueler said, I'm not going to go over there near that. I'm not touching that. So they delayed the flight while a local beekeeper came out. Apparently, these bees are a protected species. And so they had to call in this guy who got the honeybee colony gathered up in some kind of a container and carted them off safely. And apparently, it's not unusual for these big bee populations to kind of split, colonies to split, and the queen goes with one of the groups, and then the other group is just lost without the queen, and they just try to find something to call mom. And apparently this airplane met their whatever they were looking for. So, hey, it's big. It's maybe not a queen, but it's something big, and it's something that flies. So why not? That could be the queen. Anyway, so that was kind of weird. You don't hear stories about bees delaying a flight very often. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to press the pause button because, believe it or not, it's already rapidly approaching the time that I had arranged with my first officer to meet for dinner here in Portland. So I'm going to put this thing on pause, and then after my dinner, I'm going to come back and we're going to finish the show. So, of course, you know, being a podcast, the magic of podcasting, you'll have no idea. I'll just pick up from where I left off, and we'll continue this podcast. So I'll be right back. Well, hey, folks, I am on the street, as you can tell, a little bit of different sound. Man, I can't talk anymore. Blah, 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 blah. Anyway, I am on the streets of beautiful Portland, Maine. Not a cloud in the... Well, no, I take that back. There's some clouds over there to my right. Heading down toward the downtown, the port area of Portland. And I'm meeting my first officer or co-pilot, whichever you prefer, down here at a Irish pub that is supposed to have some pretty decent beer and some local seafood, as well as other pub grub, and if that doesn't look good, we'll go somewhere else. But anyway, I was just thinking about my whole dessert. Oh, I've got a skateboard. Just thinking about my whole talk just recently about the United 737 and the bird strike, and then my discussion about indicated airspeeds and true airspeeds and ground speeds. I hope I didn't confuse everybody with that, and I hope that I didn't confuse myself and say something that was wrong. But I guess the main point is that, you know, speed is life in this job, and it's good to have some kind of an indication of speed, even if it's not directly airspeed. We can, as pilots, kind of determine, you know, using whatever source available, hopefully what our speed is approximately, so we can continue to fly safely. So anyway, I'll hit the pause button here on this recording device, and then once I get down toward the restaurant / pub, maybe I'll do another little snippet. So that's it for now.
Well, I'm approaching Re-Raw Irish Pub, and I see Jim, my first officer, standing outside, looking really cool. So, hey, Jim, say hello to all my listeners.
Hello, all you listeners
out there.
You don't
have to talk that loud. Anyway, so I've arrived, so we're going to go in and take a look at the menu and maybe have a nice cold pint or two. So, talk to you in a minute.
Sandwich.
Well, hey, I'm at the, how do you pronounce this? Re-Raw?
Re-Raw.
Re-Raw Pub in Portland, Maine, and we were just served our dinners, which is fish and chips, and boy, it looks awesome. I haven't tasted it yet. Good thumbs up from Jim, my first officer. And anyway, so I have a question for you. Okay, a guy sent me some feedback a couple episodes ago, and he kind of said that he doesn't like to be called a co-pilot. He wants to be called a first officer.
Right.
Do you care about that?
I don't. No.
Okay. I don't either.
You know what I get called a lot, actually, is a co-captain.
Co-captain.
Yeah, and I've never,
you know, when you think about it, you really are a co-captain.
Yeah, exactly.
Or a captain in training, as they say.
But it doesn't bother me. No.
Yeah, okay.
Co-pilot, first officer, pilot.
Okay, and then Christopher Van Veen from New Hampshire sent me some feedback, and he asked me a question. He said, what are your three favorite airports, and what are your three least favorite airports? So do you have any ideas about that? What are your three favorite airports? And it doesn't have to necessarily be... Well, it doesn't necessarily have to be... Well, I think so, yeah, but it doesn't have to be because of the facilities of our job. It could be because they have great beers, or they have a great restaurant, or whatever, like, or whatever.
I say Boston.
Yeah.
Portland, Maine.
Yeah. I like Portland too. I guess I could count that as one of my favorites.
General aviation airport in there.
Okay.
Katana down on Martha's Vineyard. It's an all grass strip. It's really cool.
Katana.
Yeah, Katana. I don't even know if it's still open because I haven't flown down there.
A grass strip?
Did you fly?
Was that a passenger operation that you flew down there?
I don't think they ever flew a passenger airplane. But they had. It was very well maintained. You know, firm surface grass strips. They had like three or four runways. You know, well marked. It's a great little airport.
You know, I don't think I've ever landed a airliner on a grass strip.
Yeah,
and I hope I never get yes. have the opportunity.
If you do, something's really
wrong. How about your three least favorite?
LaGuardia.
Why?
Because I've had the worst delays probably ever in my life there.
Okay.
At both of my airline jobs. probably Chicago, O'Hare. Just because, once again, delays, very high pressure from the controllers. You know, they rattle off instructions really fast, expect you to understand them, and if you don't, they chew you out for it.
Or they don't give you a chance to even.
Yeah, they don't even give you a chance
read them
to
back.
Yeah, because they say your instructions, and then they immediately go into United 123. Turn right on blah 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 blah.
Yeah.
Although I like Chicago layovers, I just don't like the airport.
Right, right.
My third least favorite. I don't know. Nothing else strikes my ear.
Okay.
Comes to my
That's
attention.
That's fair. Okay.
So.
Cool. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. Let's eat.
Ciao. Yeah, this fish is really tasty.
Okay, I'm back. And as you heard, had a great dinner at Re-Raw, R-I-R-A. Again, not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. A nice little Irish pub atmosphere. On the harbor in Portland, Maine, and the fish and chips were awesome, and the beer was really good too. I think it was called Baxter's from Lewiston, Maine, and I had the IPA, really really good IPA, my favorite kind of style. Okay, let's continue, shall we? Well, I kind of covered the piece of feedback that Christopher Van Veen sent me via Facebook. If you want to follow me on Facebook, that's Captain Jeff, CaptJeff, or Airline Pilot Guy on Facebook. And as Jim mentioned, one of his favorites is Boston, then Portland, Maine, and then the private grass strip, or not private, but the grass strip on Martha's Vineyard, which I've never been to, personally. When I thought about this about a week ago, I put down as my favorites Portland, Oregon, and the reason for that is I love craft brewed beer in Portland, Oregon. In my opinion, is one of the best places in the country to go. LaGuardia, because I love flying, hand-flying airplanes, and I love the expressway visual approach, and I also love the river visual approach, and our nation's capital, DCA. So those are my second choice of favorite airports. And Honolulu International Airport in Hawaii, because the weather is always beautiful. Okay, least favorites. Probably one of my least favorites is Kennedy, John F. Kennedy, in New York. And not because the airport's that bad, it's just that the airport congestion can really be taxing, especially if you're taking off or landing during the international push, which is in the late afternoon, early evening. And then one of my least favorite airports used to be St. Louis Lambert Field. And that was because when TWA was operating out of there, and then shortly after American bought TWA, it was very, very busy, lots of traffic. They only had the two runways, and the runways were, they're not really parallel runways. They are kind of slightly divergent, convergent, and it was not unusual, especially when you were landing to the southeast, that you were actually flying approach paths that were kind of crisscrossing each other until you got closer to the runway. And that was one of those things that I didn't like. But now going into St. Louis Lambert Field is a piece of cake, because it's like a ghost town, hardly any traffic at all anymore. And they have three runways. So that's no longer on my list of least favorites. So most of the airports I like flying into, because I just like flying. Okay, let's move on to some feedback from Oliver in Europe. Hello, Jeff. Have written to you a few times on Facebook, but got no response, so I've opted for email. And I wrote back to him, I never saw your Facebook posting, so I apologize for that. But hey, the email worked great, and if you want to send feedback to me via email, it's probably the sure bet way to do it. That's feedback@airlinepilotguy.com. And if you want to send me some voice feedback, that's 304-99-PILOT, 304-997-4568. And you could also go to the website, Airline Pilot Guy, and click on that little tab on the right side of the window, and then you can leave me voice feedback that way as well. Hope you're well. Quite enjoy your take on certain aspects of our job, plus the view of a North American colleague. I'm a skipper for a major budget airline in Europe, and agree with many of your opinions on the state of actual flying in airlines and the reliance, and in the case of Airbus, of automatics, and in some cases, too little knowledge of the systems and how they work on an Airbus. I remember when I started flying the aircraft, how many times I've heard my colleagues respond when the aircraft did something that they weren't expecting, "Oh, it's just an Airbus thing." The longer I fly it, the more I realize it's quite logical, and like many computer-based objects, what you put in, you get out. Yeah, like garbage in, garbage out, like most computer systems. Anyway, the point I wanted to make is that even though many of our examiners tend to be testers rather than trainers, we have a system set up over here the past few years where once a year we do a line-oriented exercise, an LOE, where we take turns, 4 hours each, of flying a line flight, and get given three failures of varying difficulty without any prior knowledge of the types of failure. This I find to be a great way of learning in both realism and making you aware of weaknesses in system knowledge. Added to this, they have added 30-minute slots where we fly raw data approaches, circuits, and lucky us, skippers get to do it single engine. Anyway, that was a little sarcasm there, I think. Anyway, it's all good stuff because I put in around 850 hours a year and have even found myself getting a little lazy and using the automatics more and more. Hope this finds you well. From an Aussie lost in Europe. Well, thank you so much, Demasio Oliver, for sending in the feedback. And I really do appreciate your perspective. And I regard you as a friend and fellow peer in the airline industry. It's always good to hear from folks in different parts of the world. You know, we do at ACME have that kind of training as well, the LOEs or LOFT type of training exercises. And I thought it was just me. I thought maybe I just wasn't looking in the right place to find out information about possible scenarios for failures and that kind of thing in the training. But perhaps that we have the same kind of deal every other cycle where we go in and not really sure what we're going to get, and then we deal with it. And it's, as you said, line-oriented, where it's not multiple unlikely, incredible failures, but more likely, more common things that you would probably encounter, like engine failures or whatever, on your normal line operation. But the part about the 30-minute slots where you get to hand-fly the airplane, nope, not at ACME. I have not seen that in many, many years. So glad to see that some of the airlines out there are doing that, and I hope that all of us, all of our airlines, start doing that as well, because I really do think that's important, as you do. So thanks again for your feedback. I'm looking forward to hearing more from you, sir. Okay, let's go to... Oh, Jimmy Akin. Jimmy Akin is a Catholic apologist, and he's a good friend of mine. He's also part of our podcasting network, the StarQuest Production Network, of which I'm a member. And I consider him a very close personal friend. And he sent me this feedback. If someone has been thrown into a tailspin, does that mean that they're experiencing too much roll or too much yaw? And Jimmy, in case you didn't hear it, on episode number 17, I believe, of the Airline Pilot Guy, I talked about in depth about spinning because somebody else had asked the same type of question. And but in general, I can tell you that in aviation, a spin is an aggravated stall resulting in autorotation about the spin axis where the aircraft follows a corkscrew downward path. And spins can be entered intentionally or unintentionally from any flight attitude from which, or practically any airspeed. All that is required is sufficient yaw rate while an aircraft is stalled. So to answer your question, it's too much yaw. If you do a descending, rolling type of maneuver, the wing is still flying throughout the entire maneuver. It's just rolling about the longitudinal axis. But if you introduce a lot of yaw, adverse yaw, and a stall put together, that's what a spin is. So thanks for your question. And if you want more information about spins, listen to Airline Pilot Guy episode number 17, or you can go to the Wikipedia spin, in parentheses, flight page, and I'll have a link to that in the show notes. Thanks again, Jimmy. Okay, Josh Chambliss, or Chambliss, writes, "Hi, Captain Jeff. I have two wholly unrelated questions," and that's wholly not as in spiritually holy, but wholly as in wholly. First, a few episodes ago, when discussing the pending changes for rest regulations in the UK and Europe, I found myself wondering what regulations are enforced for an international flight crew. If the United States and Europe's minimums for crew rest differ, is an international flight crew subject to the guidelines of the country from which the flight departs or the nation where the airline is registered? It's a bit scary to think that if I stuck to a U.S. airline, they might be able to fudge their rest when in another nation with more lax guidelines. I would hope that this isn't the case. Okay, to answer that question... it isn't the case. the if you fly for a U.S. airline, all the rest rules for the U.S. airlines apply, no matter where you're flying. Okay, question number two. Whilst eating my breakfast at the airport this morning, I noticed the engines of the aircraft out the window were angled slightly. The front of the engine seemed to be a bit higher than the rear. I'm not an expert, but the aircraft in question appeared to be a DC-9 or an MD-80 series. My first instinct is that it seems inefficient, but I'm sure there's a good reason. Can you provide any insight? Yes, I can. The main reason for setting the engine nacelles at an angle is to align the engine inlet with the local flow of air, the angle where it's coming up over the wings. If you looked at a computer model of an airplane in a wind tunnel, or just an airplane in the wind tunnel with the little smoke that they put over it, you'll notice as the relative wind hits the wing, it goes up over the top surface of the wing and then comes back down. And then if you look at the general flow pattern of that wind or relative wind, you'll notice that it's kind of angling down as it hits toward the back part of the airplane. And so aircraft manufacturers design the angle or the mounted angle of the engine to match the relative airflow as closely as possible so that they get the greatest surface area of that engine inlet facing the incoming relative wind. So the reason for the slightly angled upward inlet as opposed to the back end of the airplane or the back end of the engine is to kind of achieve the most efficient operation of the engine. That's also because, I don't know if you noticed this, but if you look at pictures of wing-mounted engines, and I've noticed this before myself and I've wondered, why is that? The front end of the engine or the inlet end of the engine is faced kind of a little bit more closely or angled in toward like the nose of the airplane. And the aft part of the engine is facing more outward, so it kind of has a toe-in kind of configuration. And the reason for that is, if you looked again at a simulation of how the air flows around the fuselage of the airplane and over the wings, it kind of flows, obviously, from front to back, but it also kind of goes slightly outward. So the aircraft manufacturers mount the engines on the pylons so that the front of the engine is actually a little bit closer to the fuselage than the back end of the engine. And that's, again, to increase the efficiency of the engines. So thanks for answering these questions so thoroughly. That's what he says. Thank you, Josh. How did you know? I look forward to hearing your thoughts. So there you go. Those are my thoughts. And if you have any more questions about anything, please do not hesitate to send them to feedback@airlinepilotguide.com. Appreciate it, Josh. From my good friend, also an employee of Acme, she is a domestic revenue management specialist, Jan Pitts. She wrote to me and was telling me about the Amelia Earhart investigation of, you know, they're still trying to figure out what happened to Amelia Earhart. And there's an organization called, the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery, T-I-G-H-A-R. I guess they pronounce that TIGER, is a group that has been, doing expeditions, and they're planning an expedition here in the future to go out and look for some more evidence for where Amelia ended up getting lost or crashing or whatever. But apparently, dozens of radio signals that were previously dismissed in the past have been found to be credible transmissions from the famed pilot Amelia Earhart just after her Lockheed Model 10E Electra went down on July 2nd, 1937, according to a new study. Looks like they also found an island in the southwestern Pacific Republic of Kiribati, which the group believes proves where Amelia Earhart's plane went down nearly 75 years ago. They found a cosmetic jar that looks eerily similar to that of Dr. C.H. Berry's freckle ointment The ointment was marketed in the early 20th century as a concoction guaranteed to make freckles fade, and it's well documented that Amelia had freckles and disliked having them. And they think that this jar and the freckle ointment is a possible match, and that possibly this might tie this island with her last known existence. And so now they're going to begin a high-tech underwater search for parts of the plane in July, I guess last month, marking the 75th anniversary of Earhart's disappearance. So look forward to hearing about the results of this latest expedition to the Southwest Pacific, and I hope they are able to find out where what happened to Amelia Earhart and where her airplane is and such. So thank you, Jan, for providing me with that information. And if you follow this, as I think you do, please let me know if they find anything. Okay, speaking of the Southwest Pacific, in New Zealand, Nick writes, I was trawling through the Aviation Herald, came across a report about a laser being shown in the eye of a first officer incapacitating him. It jogged my memory back to Airline Pilot Guy episode 36, Deja Vu. Take a look at the post on my blog, where you will find a link to the report. It just goes to show that these laser occurrences are on the rise and are indeed quite dangerous. As a note to the laser conversation, I remember being told by some of my colleagues in the Air Force, the New Zealand Air Force, that the NVGs, night vision goggles, we used can be completely destroyed if lasers are shown at them, as they are such sensitive instruments, not cheap. Okay, and he says, any shout out on the Airline Pilot Guy podcast for my blog and future podcast, The Pilot Crew Room, would be super appreciated. I'd love some of your listeners to check out the blog and leave some feedback so I can improve it. It can be found at www.pilotcrewroom, that's all one word, pilotcrewroom/WordPress. He puts a slash in there, but I think it's actually .wordpress.com. So that's pilotcrewroom.wordpress.com. So please, listeners, check out Nick's website and future podcast on pilotcrewroom.wordpress.com. I'll have a link to that in the show notes. And keep up the good work, Nick. If you'll remember, Nick has sent me feedback in the past. He was in the New Zealand Air Force, and he is getting some training to get his commercial ratings. And I think he is looking to get involved in corporate aviation. So we look forward to hearing more about your journey, sir. Okay. I requested a couple episodes back that you go to my iTunes page and give me some reviews. And many of you did that, and thank you so much. Let me just tell you about some of the folks that heeded my request. Michael Rogers gave me a great rating. Everybody did, actually. Thank you, all of you. Is It Going to Rain? Also left me some nice feedback. MPMKS, thank you, sir, or ma'am. DFW Flyer gave me a 5-star review. Thank you, sir, or ma'am. Superb from Pan Am 747, 5-star review. J Love You Ola, JLOVUOLA, gave me a great review on iTunes. Thank you. Christopher Van Veen, we heard from him earlier in the show, asking about my 3 least favorite and most favorite airports. He left me a nice review there on iTunes as well. Finn and Andy, as well, left me a nice review. Thank you, everybody, for doing that. I really do appreciate it. I'm hoping that that will help steer people who are looking for aviation podcasts to at least check out mine. I think that mine is a little bit different than everybody else's. There are a lot of great aviation podcasts. Let me just say this right now. Some of the ones I listen to are the Aviation Geeks podcast, great podcast. Oh, heck. I know I'm going to leave out some, but I listen to several of them. If you do a search on iTunes for aviation podcasts, there are a lot of them. A lot of them have more of a general aviation focus, which I don't really do a lot of talking about because I don't really, that's not my expertise. My expertise is the commercial airline end of aviation, and my perspective is in relation to that. But I really enjoy listening to all aspects of aviation, and I appreciate everybody out there who's making an effort to give as much information as possible to the public. So check out all the great aviation podcasts on in the iTunes directory. And I just wanted to for mine to be there as well, just in case somebody might be looking for something more oriented toward airline aviation. Okay, Mariana, one of my listeners, wrote to me and sent a link to this article. Kind of interesting. This is outside of the Providence, Rhode Island area. A pilot whose plane experienced engine trouble and ditched in Block Island Sound on Monday was rescued from the water. The pilot was picked up by a private boat. The pilot walked out of the Coast Guard station, got into a truck, and drove away an hour later. He's okay. The single-seat plane, which was pulling a banner with a marriage proposal, went down in the water between Watch Hill and Block Island. It had taken off from Westerly Airport about 3 p.m. Several Mayday calls were made before the plane went down. The pilot reported engine trouble. And again, this airplane was a banner-pulling airplane. It was pulling a marriage proposal. And Mariana wrote, I hope that the answer was yes. I hope that whoever it was, the message was intended for actually got to see the banner. Wouldn't that be a bummer? You pay all that money to have your marriage proposal flying by and the airplane crashes in the water. Maybe a sign from God that perhaps this marriage is not something that he wants. I don't know. Thanks again, Mariana, for submitting your feedback. Marshalling. This is from... Heck, I don't know who this is from. Well, somebody from the Brussels area. I guess I forgot to write down who this was that sent this to me. Sorry. This was on Facebook. He said, Hi, Captain Jeff. From the Brussels area, a nice video on how to park a plane. Nothing new for you, of course. Is this signal language the same all over the planet? And there's a nice CNN.com international video of her... being instructed on how to marshal in an Airbus, and I'm not sure what the airline was, but I think it was British BA, British Airlines. And so it was kind of cool. And yeah, the marshalling signals are pretty much an international standard. So yeah, that's all I can say about that. I wrote to him that I thought that the signal for stop now is what used to be the emergency stop signal, but I've never seen anybody use the normal stop signal, putting your hands together or the wands together. Everybody always makes them in the shape of an X, and I guess over time that just became the symbol for just a regular stop. So as we're coming into our parking spot, if we don't have one of the automated systems or the lights, we look at the marshaller. And they're using their wands or their hands, and they're kind of have their two hands parallel. They're kind of waving them, bringing you in. Maybe if you need to turn a little bit to the left or the right, they put one arm down, which signals where, you know, your brake should be on that side of the airplane, the wing, and the wing on the other side should kind of swing around a little bit more to kind of steer you in. And then when you're getting close to the stopping point, you bring your arms or your wands together. And that's the signal to stop. So, thanks for your question. Yes, I think that in answer to it, the signals for marshalling are pretty much standard all throughout the world. More needles in your food. Remember, it was a Delta flight a couple of weeks ago coming in from the Netherlands, Amsterdam, and some of the first-class sandwiches had needles, like sewing needles, in them. Well, maybe another copycat incident. I don't think it's a terrorist thing. an Air Canada flight from Victoria, British Columbia to Toronto had the same kind of thing. Six needles, or I'm not sure how many needles in this case, but some needles were found in some food on that flight as well. Again, they're investigating it, but they don't think it's a terrorist act. They think it's just more of a copycat thing. This is something that concerns me a lot. Next-gen air traffic control vulnerable to hackers spoofing planes out of thin air. A hacker attack that leads to planes dropping from the sky is the stuff of every cyber war doomsday prophecy, but some security researchers imagine a less sensational, if equally troubling, possibility. Hundreds or thousands of aircraft radioing in their approach to an air traffic control tower, and no way to sort through which one of these are real and which are ghost plane signals crafted by a malicious hacker. At the Black Hat and DEFCON security conference last week in Las Vegas, I guess it was a couple weeks ago now, two security researchers plan to give separate talks on the same troubling issue. By the year 2020, a new system known as Automated Dependent Surveillance Broadcast, or ADS-B, will be required as the primary mode of aircraft tracking and control for commercial aircraft in the U.S., earlier in other countries such as Australia. And both researchers say that ADS-B lacks both the encryption necessary to keep those communications private and the authentication necessary to prevent spoofed communications from mixing with real ones, potentially allowing hackers to fabricate messages and even entire aircraft with radio tools that are cheaper and more accessible than ever before. And here's a quote from André Costin, a PhD candidate at the French security institute Euricom. Anyone can technically transmit these messages. Ghosts in the air traffic. He's giving a talk Black Hat, called Ghosts in the Air. It's practically possible for a medium tech-savvy person to mount an attack and impersonate a plane that's not there. ADS-B promises to make air traffic control easier, cheaper, and in many ways safer by allowing airplanes to transmit their locations by radio frequency instead of depending on towers to use radar to track and coordinate them. But without encryption or authentication, ADS-B both exposes flyers to more potential tracking and fails to provide a trusted authority for planes' location to the same degree as radar. So looks like there's some vulnerability with the ADS-B system because there's not any kind of secure transmission protocol there. And I think that's something they're going to have to fix. Now, they later in the article, they talk about having to spend a lot of money to make it more secure. But I think you're just going to have to spend the money on it because we can't have people out there. You know, it's one thing, folks out there with lasers pointing them at us. But, using relatively cheap technology to spoof airplane signals is another matter entirely, and I think that's something we really should be concerned about. So hopefully this will raise the red flag, and the appropriate people will take heed and make sure that these are more secure and we don't have this problem. I talked about in a couple podcasts ago about Senator Inouye or Inhofe, excuse me, from Oklahoma, pushing for the Pilots' Bill of Rights. It was passed. President Barack Obama signed into law the Pilots' Bill of Rights on August 3rd. The legislation guarantees pilots under investigation by the FAA expanded protection against enforcement actions via access to investigative reports, air traffic control and flight service recordings, and also requires the FAA to provide the evidence being used as the basis of enforcement at least 30 days in advance of action. So I think that is a good thing, although I heard from somebody, they told me that they thought that this was a bad thing, and I asked the person that sent me that feedback to let me know why this person thought that this was a negative thing. But I think all in all, the Pilot's Bill of Rights is going to be a good thing for us pilots out there. Okay. You know, I haven't talked about this at all in past episodes, and it's something that's been affecting one of our fighters, the F-22. And this has been something that's been going on for quite some time. And in fact, you may have noticed or you may have watched on television. I'm not sure it was 60 Minutes or ABC News Nightline investigation where they had some folks, F-22 pilots on the show basically saying, I'm not going to fly the airplane because it's dangerous and until they fix this problem. Well, apparently they've had several incidents and even some accidents where pilots were experiencing hypoxia-like symptoms, lack of oxygen to the brain, and blacking out or getting close to it. And they couldn't figure out what was causing this problems, but this problem. But this article says that the Pentagon is confident that the mystery F-22 fighter problem is solved, and they believe that the problem is associated with a part of the G-suit that was specially made and configured for the F-22 Raptor. And they think that by improving or replacing a valve in this this vest that kind of adds pressure to your upper body, your upper torso, to keep the pressure of oxygen sufficient to stay conscious during flight was the problem. Although in my reading and research, I found that there were some incidents that had nothing to do with actually flying the airplane. People were experiencing symptoms of hypoxia that were never in flight. So I'm not sure if this is the problem or not. I'm trying to find the place in this article where they talk about that. Let's see. When asked by a reporter if the new solution could also account for the at least five instances in which the Air Force said ground crews working on the F-22s experienced their own hypoxia-like symptoms, and the spokesperson said he did not have specifics on those incidents. So, a little bit interesting situation here. I'm not sure that the vest and the valve is really the solution to the problem or not. We'll have to see. Thank you for whoever sent that information to me. I appreciate that. It may have been my anonymous listener in Washington. Okay, more air rage. I don't know if you heard about this or not. On Alaska Airlines, an older gentleman got a little bit outraged and upset because somebody in the seat in front of them, a woman seated in front of him, refused to turn off her overhead reading light. It was a late night flight, like one of those all-nighters, red eyes or whatever. Let's see, the 50-year-old man from Tacoma apparently became upset when the woman seated in front of him refused to turn off her overhead reading light. The man went to talk to the flight attendants to demand that the woman's reading light be turned off. When the attendants told the man that the woman was entitled to keep the light on, he flew into a rage. And he started shouting expletives at both the woman and others on the plane. He also threatened to annoy the woman for the duration of the flight by hitting the back of her seat over and over again. So the man, who was traveling with his adult son and daughter, was met at the Bellingham International Airport by five sheriff's deputies. He was questioned and allowed to continue on his home in Tacoma. They determined he was not a flight risk. It just sounds like kind of an ornery old man who wanted to sleep on his all-nighter flight and was irritated because somebody wanted to exercise their own personal freedoms and rights by turning on their light and reading. Sounds like this guy has a lot of problems. I mentioned on a previous podcast about the free NASA app on the iOS system, the iOS, what do you call that, the environment, in other words, iPads, iPhones, etc., called Sector 33, a game that simulates air traffic control in the, I think it's a fictitious sector called Sector 33. And fortunately, my good friend Kevin Cox, he's an air traffic controller in Southern California, sent in this feedback.
Hello, Captain Jeff. This is Kevin Cox, the American Catholic Controller, working at Sector 33, and I wanted to give you a review of the game. Again, you are an air traffic controller working Sector 33 at Oakland Center and responsible for aircraft in your airspace. There are three routes available which meet at Modesto en route to San Francisco. You must ensure that all aircraft under your control are separated by not less than 3 miles. Each scenario lasts a little over 3 minutes and increases in difficulty. All aircraft start on their routes at 600 knots. They maintain the same altitude. You have only two options to adjust the aircraft to affect separation: speed changes or a change in routing. Again, each scenario becomes more difficult with more aircraft under your control. Some routes may not be flown due to weather. You must score a certain amount of points to get access to more advanced levels. You receive 100 points for each aircraft under your control, and points are deducted for any separation error. You fail if you break the 3 mile separation. Airline call sign and navigational fix abbreviations are accurate. A few cool features are you can move the aircraft's data tag, which is great due to the limited space on the iPhone screen. You can zoom in to get real accurate with your separation. One of the coolest things is when you change an aircraft's speed or route, you get a verbal response. It was pretty funny the other night. My wife and I were getting ready for bed. She was reading and I was playing the game. It was pretty quiet and I had forgotten to turn the volume down on my iPhone. I changed one of the aircraft's route, and in a very loud voice came the response, "Roger, Delta 88, changing route to Mina, direct Codale, direct Modesto." My wife looked at me and asked, "What are you doing?" I said I was playing an air traffic control game. She replied, "Don't you get enough of that at work?" "Sorry, honey." I recommend Sector 33 to anyone who likes a challenge. Each scenario I've played is only 3.5 minutes long, so you don't have to spend a lot of time in the game at any time. I'm going to keep playing the game so I can become an expert. So that's my review of Sector 33. Keep up the good work, Captain Jeff. Take care, and again, as always, God bless.
Wow, that's dedication. One of my great, most dedicated listeners. Actually risking marital peace by playing an air traffic control game in bed. Thank you, sir. Thanks for the great feedback, Kevin. I appreciate it. And if you want to check out the game that Kevin's talking about, that's Sector 33. Just do a search on your iPhone, iPad, or iOS device. Okay, let's see. Let me play this. Now, you always know when I play the Bad Boys song that it has something to do with TSA. But you know what? I think a majority of the time the TSA is doing good things, not bad things. It's just we hear about all the bad stuff, right? And in this case, I have some good news. In Miami, last month or last week, July 5th, last month, a woman who was beaten, kidnapped, and brought to the Miami International Airport by her assailants could have been forced to fly with them to New York, but two alert Transportation Security Administration agents noticed that something was wrong. In airport surveillance video, the victim is seen arriving at the terminal on July 5th. She wore a scarf around her face to conceal the injuries sustained in an alleged beating. Two Miami TSA officers said they detected something was wrong with her. When she came closer, I realized she was black and blue on both sides of her face, her forehead. I noticed her shoulder looked like she had a big rug burn, said a TSA officer named Ray, who did not want to use his full name nor show his face on television. Later, I found out from her that they had dragged her across the floor. She looked afraid, said another TSA officer, Danielle, who also did not want to be fully identified. The fear came from a beating the woman took inside a fifth-floor room at the Best Western Hotel in North Miami, police said. Detectives said the woman came to South Florida with a group on vacation, but it turned into a nightmare when one woman accused the victim of having an intimate relationship with her boyfriend. She was then beaten and kidnapped. She was forced to go to the bank and withdraw funds, threatened, and taken to the airport for a flight back to New Jersey. That's when two TSA officers who are trained to detect suspicious behavior that could be an indicator of a terrorist attack used those skills to save the woman as she was about to go through the security checkpoint. The way she was acting, we actually thought it was a case of an abduction because she looked very young. Her partner approached her and asked her to come with them. She told us basically to help her and to take her away from the people that she was traveling with. And so other officers then stepped in to detain four individuals, two women and two men. It turns out that the men were released, but the women were charged and arrested for abduction, kidnapping, and assault. So good on you, TSA. Some great, great work helping rescue that young lady in Miami, at the Miami International Airport. Okay, you may have heard this also. You know that after the 9/11 events, the terrorist attack on the United States, people getting trained in flight schools in the United States commandeered airplanes, ruthlessly killed flight crews, flew these airplanes along with their innocent passengers into the World Trade Center and other places. After that, the TSA put in procedures to make sure that anybody on a no-fly list, because they were suspected of terrorist activity, were allowed to enroll in flight schools in the U.S. without a background check. Well, there's a loophole here because that rule only applied to foreigners or people that were not U.S. citizens. Turns out that American citizens who are on the no-fly list because they are suspected of terrorist activity are allowed to enroll in flight schools in the United States without a background check. And the security loophole was raised during a hearing a couple weeks ago to examine the Homeland Security Department's programs to screen foreigners who attend flight schools. So I believe that loophole is going to be filled. And so if you're an American on the no-fly list, you're not going to be allowed to enroll in a flight school or attain a certificate. Of course, you don't need to have a license. You just need to know how to fly an airplane. So, again, I'm glad that that loophole was discovered, and I'm glad it's going to be filled. In relation to that, I received this from the FAA safety team email. I'm on their email list, and it is an alert they sent out. And said, with the recent publicity about individuals being on the do not fly list and receiving flight instruction, we want to remind certified flight instructors, CFIs, that they have certain responsibilities to fulfill before instructing a non-U.S. citizen. This notice is to remind flight instructors of their responsibilities under the Code of Federal Regulations to notify the Transportation Security Administration, the TSA, when providing flight instruction to foreign pilots. So any of you out there listening, if you're a CFI and you're giving instruction, and a foreigner signs up to your flight school, he's one of your students, he or she, it is your obligation and responsibility to notify the TSA that they are trying to receive instruction. So, there you go. Another TSA story. There is a move around the country at several places to replace the federal TSA screeners at airports with private companies. And Sacramento International Airport is the latest to get a preliminary okay to use private security screeners. So that's good. I think that as long as they're doing the job correctly and they're properly trained, I think this is a way for us to spend less money on security because most of the airports in the United States who are protected by and screened by the TSA are, you know, that's coming out of our taxpayer money, our federal budget. And it's a big amount of money. So I'm glad to see that some of these places are using private security firms to do this kind of screening. So good job, Sacramento. Sadly, you remember a couple weeks ago, the in Denver, the in Aurora, Colorado, actually, the opening night of the new Batman movie, where the crazy dude opened fire and killed several people. James Holmes, I think is his name, 24 years old. He killed 12 and injured 58 others at the Dark Knight premiere, or Dark Knight Rises in Aurora. Well, in response to that, United Airlines is offering, or did offer, free flights to Aurora shooting families so they can travel to be with loved ones and attend funerals. And so I just wanted to mention that. Thank you, United Airlines, for graciously providing free transportation for those affected by this senseless tragedy in Colorado. Well, that looks like it's time for us to wrap up the show. Thank you for hanging in there with me. Hope you enjoyed it. Sorry I wasn't able to put one out last week, but hey, I'm trying to make up for it. And just a reminder that you too can send feedback at airlinepilotguy.com, 304-99-PILOT, 304-997-4568. That's my feedback telephone number. And you can go to the airlinepilotguy.com website, click on that tab over there on the right side, and send me some voicemail that way. I'm on Facebook, Captain Jeff, CAPT.JEFF, at Facebook.com. And on Twitter, I'm Airline Pilot Guy. And again, my website, AirlinePilotGuy.com. You can also find the Airline Pilot Guy show on Stitcher while on the go with Stitcher Smart Radio. On-demand news, talk, and more on your mobile phone. The latest episode is always available for you. No syncing needed. And no memory or storage wasted. Available on your iPhone, iPad, Android phones, and beyond. Downloading is easy. Go to my affiliate site, or the promo site that I have, which is Stitcher.com, Stitcher.com/airlinepilot. That's Stitcher.com/airlinepilot. And there you can download the free app for your mobile phone or mobile device. And until we meet again, remember this.
In this day and age of automated cockpits, hand flying is in danger of becoming a lost art. We have to remember as pilots that we are there because of our flying skills.
Wishing you clear skies, unlimited visibility, and tailwinds. Take care, and God bless.